Welcome to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Bull Publishers. This episode delves into Mike Martin's latest book, How to Fight War. Let me ask you, has any war in history gone according to plan? Monarchs, dictators, and elected leaders alike have a dismal record on military decision-making. This not only wastes the lives of civilians, the enemy, and one's own soldiers, but also fails to achieve geopolitical objectives. Conflict scholar and former soldier Mike Martin takes the reader through the hard, elegant logic of fighting a conclusive interstate war that solves geopolitical problems and reduces future conflict. In cool and precise prose, he outlines how to orchestrate military forces from infantry to information and strategy to tactics. It has been described as an indispensable guide to understanding modern warfare, especially the decisions made by politicians and generals, both good and bad. In this episode of PageCast, Mike is joined by Abel Esterhazer, author and head of the Department of Strategic Studies at the Faculty of Military Science at Stellenbosch University. Enjoy the chat.
Good morning or good afternoon, and welcome to this episode of PageCast. We're going to talk about Mike Martin's book, How to Fight a War. What an interesting title for a book, Martin. And I want to start off perhaps just a brief introduction, the two of us. I'm Professor Abel Esterhazer, teaching in the Faculty of Military Science at the University of Stellenbosch, and that is the faculty that is plucked into our military academy in Saldanha. Can I give you an opportunity, Mike?
Hey, hi, Abel. My name's Mike Martin. I'm a former British Army officer, spent a lot of time serving in Afghanistan, and I'm now a senior fellow at the War Studies Department in King's College London.
Interesting. And of course, the author of a very interesting book on how to fight a war. And I want to start off with a question about every book starting with an idea, Mike. What was the idea behind this book? Why the book? And where did you start off? Where was it born, so to speak?
It actually grew out of my Twitter feed. So I tweet under Thresh Thought, we've got to call it X now, don't we? I tweet under Thresh Thought, and I tweet on Afghanistan where I served. And then when the Ukraine war kicked off, I found myself putting together long threads to describe the war as I saw it. And it seemed to me, two things sort of occurred to me in that process. First, the way the media were presenting the war didn't seem to me to match actually what was going on the ground. And you often get that in wars. But the other thing that struck me was, as I do this thread on, I don't know, Russian logistics or something, suddenly all sorts of people would be asking questions. Well, hang on, well, why is fuel and ammunition the most important thing when it comes to armies? Or, well, hang on a minute, what about tires? I think maybe people remember there was this famous thread by a tire expert on why the Russian tires were so rubbish. And as these questions came into my threads, and I just answered them, and really, someone who'd had experience and perhaps studied war, the answers might seem obvious, but they certainly weren't obvious to the general public and a surprising number of journalists who were writing on the war. And indeed, some politicians direct messaged me privately and said, this is really useful, I didn't understand. And it was out of that realization that actually there was no primer. There was no simple explanation of how and why you fight a war, why logistics is so important, why strategy is more important than tactics. And so working again with Hearst, which is a publisher that I've worked with before, we fairly quickly put together a few page summary of the book, and then I started writing, and it was actually quite quick to write. It's quite a short book. It's quite you know, simply phrased and clear, and it wrote itself, really, because all of that knowledge was inside my head. And well, I hope the readers like the result.
Well, the point is, nobody without a military background could have wrote the book. So bringing the military experience and academia together in the book in a way that makes for an interesting read. But it brings me to the question. I mean, who did you had in mind when you wrote the book? You made the remark in the introduction that the book was for commanders in chiefs, and I was thinking, oh well, that's an interesting remark. But who did you wrote it to? I mean, who had you met? You're always thinking about somebody if you write something like this. Who did you had in mind?
Yeah, it's a great question. As we were writing it, we played around with different styles, and actually we settled upon writing the book in the second person. So writing it directly to the commander in chief. So maybe that's a senior general or more likely a politician who's in charge of this army, because, you know, it's very obvious that politicians in the modern age are really not that skilled at the exercising of military power to achieve political ends. And that gives a real clarity to the book, because you're explaining to the commander in chief, look, strategy is important. There are three bits to it: ways, ends, and means. And this is how you balance them. And this is how you build a team in order to make sure you balance them. And this is what a good strategy looks like. And that's what a bad strategy looks like. And it's really important, commander in chief, that you get this right, because you're the only person who can set the strategy. And because you've written it in that way, it actually, I hope, appeals to the general reader, because they imagine themselves, the idea is that they imagine themselves in the shoes of the person prosecuting this war, the commander in chief, and that helps the concepts come alive. It's actually a really fun book to write.
Well, I read through it and I said to myself, I should actually recommend this to a number of politicians in the South African Parliament to develop an understanding for the military. Because, and this is the problem in many democracies in the world at the moment, that many of the people who had to make the tough decisions had no military experience or military background, and they don't really understand the military profession that they're working with. But another question, I'm always thinking about where a book like this fit into the body of military knowledge. Who is it competing with, and where does it fit in? What is the gap it is filling?
There's nothing new in this book, right? If you read it, you won't find some new strategy or new tactic. It's really a distillation of the wisdom of the ages, right? You know, from yeah. Sun Tzu and Clausewitz right up to how to use nuclear weapons. And so the gap that it fills is really that between, there are obviously a lot of very technical manuals. You know, when you go into the army, you get given the Staff Officer's Handbook, which is a sort of very technical piece. Well, you'll find a lot of that information in the book. You'll also have conceptual academic texts like Clausewitz is a classic example, theorizing about war, about how, for example, there is a trinity between the people and the armed forces and the government. And, you know, but again, how do we apply that concept? And then, of course, I think the third type of book that it's between is, and there are loads of these on the market, which are the sort of personal experiences of war. I've been to war. This is what happened. This is, you know, we fought this battle and this was what it was like. And it's the story of the first person and the comrades, and they're going through this battle. And I think really it sits between those three books. And as far as I'm aware, this is, I think, why, Mike Dwyer at Hearst was keen to publish. As far as I'm aware, there's no other book like it. And it has been picked up. I mean, obviously, we're talking now about the South African edition. It's been picked up in Germany. They're publishing in Germany. There's a Chinese language version that's coming out in America. The subcontinents are India, Pakistan. So there's other countries have picked it up as well and are working on translations at the moment, which is great.
Yeah, the title is almost a question, you know, how to fight a war, and almost implicit in that question is the question of, is there a recipe? Reading the book, I was that was sort of the first question that popped up in my mind when I saw the title of the book, is there a recipe? And so I want to ask you that question, because you answer it in the book in a way.
Is there? Yeah. Well, I think war is a mixture of an art and a science. So if it was just a science, then there would be a recipe. It would be like baking a cake. But it's not. There's judgment. And because I think critically, psychology is at the center of war, right? It's a psychological act. You're trying to beat your opponent, and that requires deception. It requires bravado. It requires, you know, getting inside your opponent's head. It requires influencing their emotions. And that's very much an art. That's not a science. And so, but of course, there is lots of technical stuff. You know, how to fire artillery, that's a science, right? You know, projectile trajectories is a science. And so really, rather than it being a recipe to war, I think what there is a number of principles that underlie it that give you ways of thinking. That's really what I'm trying to do in the book. So the book is broken up into chapters. You know, I'm sure we'll talk about this, but strategy, training, morale, intelligence, whatever. And those chapters lay out the principles. If you want to make a good strategy, this is what you've got to do. If you want to have good morale, this is what you need to do. Yeah, logistics lies on these strategies. And it's very difficult for me to tell you precisely how to organize your logistical system. But if you follow these principles, and then, you know, part of which is understanding the war you're trying to fight, you know, then you'll be able to adapt your logistical system to achieve success.
There was an interesting question that popped up in my mind whilst I was reading through the book, and I often refer to it as the all black rugby problem. And that is that the Western way of war have become so dominant, and the Western way of war have become so successful that, you know, nobody really wants to play the All Blacks because they're so good. And nobody wants to fight the West anymore because they're so good. So they've moved on onto alternative ways of fighting war. And so, You have, in a way, Western warfare, and then you have warfare as it unfolds and as it manifests in the rest of the world. And that brings the question as to the value of your book in the rest of the world.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, yeah, no one wants to go up against a US armored division with integrated air support, do they? So they end up, I don't know, the Middle East is a great example at the moment, the Houthis, you know, firing rockets at ships. No, it's a very good point. I guess the value elsewhere, you know, what we're seeing at the moment, I think, in the world is a really sub-threshold. You know, a lot of the activity is below the threshold of all-out war, obviously excepting Ukraine. And I think what you tend to find, I actually think what we're going to see over the next 10 years, and another one of the motivations for writing the book, is that at the moment we're seeing a lot of sub-threshold stuff. So the Middle East is a kind of classic example. But, you know, China and India are sniping at each other across that border. Just last year, there was a lot of stuff happening in the Russian space, Nagorno-Karabakh, and the Armenian, the Azerbaijani thing. That's a spin-off, really, from the Ukraine war and the collapse of Russian power. The Sahel, climate change, ecological collapse, what's happening with migration. So there's a lot of things that are happening below the threshold of all-out war, apart from, obviously, Ukraine. Potentially, actually, also Sudan as well is we've got forces kind of arrayed against each other there as well, you know, a few other places around the world. It does seem to me increasingly likely that it looks like we're in the foothills of a major war. And what tends to happen, if you think about the run-up to the Second World War, you had, you know, a declining power or powers, and then other powers jockeyed to try and fill that space. And we're sort of seeing that in various places around the world. And what starts out as a number of disparate conflicts at some point will agglomerate and become split by a major cleavage. So the Second World War ended up being about the Axis versus the Allied powers, but it started out as a number of different things. Manchuria and, you know, the Italians, Abyssinia, and, you know, so on and so forth, all these disparate things suddenly agglomerated into a major cleavage. And that major cleavage then becomes about the type of war that I'm talking about in the book. And so at the moment, I think you're right. It's like, well, you know, major war, is that happening? But I think we're entering an era where a major war is increasingly likely. And you know, one of the main things I've tried to get across in the book is major wars often look the same. You might have new technology. And of course, there's loads of new technology at the moment. It's happening all the time. There's new technology. The UK, for example, has just announced a successful testing of a direct energy weapon to shoot down projectiles, right? A laser beam that shoots stuff down that's incoming. Fantastic against drones, right? Which are another new invention that we've just had reshape the battlefield. But even with that new technology, the fundamental principles of war stay exactly the same. It's still about strategy. Logistics is still utterly vital. The morale of your troops is vital. And there's some other lessons as well. You know, ground forces are decisive. Naval forces and air forces support your ground forces. And if your ground forces are decisive, because battles are fought on land and people live on land, so if you want to achieve a political effect, you need people standing in your opponent's villages. Like, that's how you ultimately deliver political effect, or kicking their people out of your villages. And, you know, if you kind of boil it down, a major war always comes down to having a land army, and a land army is centered around infantry supported by tanks and artillery. It's the troika of those three. And even with drones, I don't see that changing. You know, the tanks are going to have to get better at shooting down drones. The artillery is going to have to get better at hiding, all right? And perhaps we'll change it to rocket artillery and position it further away. But ultimately, you still need those three types of forces until we get to sort of completely robotic forces. And we're a long way away from that at the moment. So yeah, I think we might be entering an era where the book, sadly, becomes more useful to a greater number of people.
Yeah, the tension between regular and irregular war is also an historical reality. I mean, that's precisely what we learn from history, that there's a tension between those types of wars. And from time to time, we know that we're going to go into a major regular war. And, you know, if you read Victor Davis Hanson, he's making the point in one of his books that that is precisely the most destructive part of war, when Western war, because this is in essence Western war that you are talking about here, turns on itself, and that type of warfare then turns on itself, and you have a regular war. I want to move on to your discussion of the intangible fundamentals, and I have to say I was quite surprised that the idea of tactics and doctrines, a doctrine on the one hand, and leadership and command on the other hand, do not feature in the discussion of the fundamentals. I was quite surprised about that.
So what were the two things that you brought up there? So tactics and
doctrine on the one hand, and command and leadership on the other. You cover command and leadership in your discussion of strategy there's an undertone of command and leadership there. But I was quite surprised in your fundamentals that you haven't made more tactics and doctrine on the one hand and command and leadership on the other hand.
You're right. I guess there are a number of ways that you can organize this, because we're trying to organize our principles into buckets, aren't we? So the four intangibles that I pull out are strategy, logistics, morale, and training. And I guess maybe perhaps you feel that because the book's written to the commander in chief, so it's really meant to be equipping the leader with how to act. But of course, leadership's utterly essential for the maintenance of morale, right? That's the most important thing for the maintenance of morale. And, you know, we see this in the civilian world. The main reason why people leave their jobs is because they don't like their boss, right? And of course, in the army, you can't leave if you don't like your, you know, if you're in a platoon and you don't like your lieutenant, tough, get on with it. But it affects your morale. You know, if you have a leader that you don't believe in, that is the number one factor. And, you know, for that reason, come to training, for that reason, militaries are among the very, very few organizations that start out by saying, right, the most important thing that we have is leaders. And so we're going to spend a year, right? The British Army, if you go and become an officer in the British Army, you go to Sandhurst for a year. That's an incredible investment in people. And some of whom, obviously, some of whom are going to stay and be general. Some of whom will only stay for 5 years. So it's a huge investment in people to develop their leadership skills and hone them so that they can be effective at delivering training, you know, leading, bolstering, enhancing morale. So I do think that's very important. And then as for doctrine, yeah, it is interesting. I guess I would say that it really depends. Doctrine comes in two flavors, doesn't it? You get the very conceptual type stuff. This yeah. is, you know, what influence operations are. And then you get the much more tactical stuff, like this is how to, this is the way that you call in an airstrike, yeah. almost like a checklist. And I guess I've split those two up, and the more tactical stuff will come in the tangible section, which I guess we're going to talk about, you know, land power, sea power, whatever. And the conceptual stuff I've sort of spread out around the different chapters. But you know, Abel, the thing about doctrine is, often armies can have the best doctrine in the world, but no one ever reads it. It's really, really interesting.
Judgment and application. Yeah.
Yeah. And armies spend a huge amount of time writing doctrine. You know, to our early discussion about where does this book fit in, you know, junior officers should read this, because are they going to sit and wade through 300 pages of information operations doctrine? Potentially not. Are they gonna, you know, and it's really, it's very, you know, if you do a kind of straw poll of junior officers, or let alone sergeants, and say, yeah, you know, have you guys read the latest infantry doctrine? Very, very few have read it, which I think is a shame, because some of it's very, very good. But I think that's the reality often in militaries. People are very busy.
I enjoyed your discussion of strategy in the book. I think it's quite well done. And of course, we all know that politics, as Clausewitz put it, is the logic of war. What I'm quite interested in is, if you look at recent wars, I mean, what is unfolding in Ukraine and what is currently unfolding in Gaza, there's a second sort of dimension to politics, and that is politics as context. And for me at the moment, you almost at a point where it seems as if politics is becoming overwhelming. It's overwhelming the traditional strategic political interface, that politics as context is becoming almost more important than politics as logic. If you understand what I'm trying to say.
Is it, so politics as context, I guess you're referring to the sort of geopolitical wraparound of those. Yeah, I think that's right. And it really, exactly, you know, you in a war, you are delivering lethal violence in order to achieve a political effect. You know, we're asking you to leave that hill. We think that's our hill. And if you're not going to leave, we're going to use lethal violence to kick you off that hill, right? It's another form of communication. But you're right. And actually, but you know, both of those conflicts that you cite, Ukraine and Gaza, are essentially at geopolitical impasses. Ukraine, of course, because after the failure of the Ukrainian counteroffensive, to achieve its goals, you know, Western support has dialed down. Obviously, that's the context of the US presidential election as well. And the fact that Trump is no fan of continuing to support Ukraine. And that creates this big impasse where it effectively stalemates the war, because there's not enough support going to the Ukrainians to land to make progress. And the Russians, you know, aren't able to make progress because, you know, morale and training in their army isn't great, and they don't have much equipment either. So it just sort of, the two sides sit there and slug it out. And then Gaza, of course, is stalemated, geopolitically stalemated currently, because everyone agrees that a two-state solution is the answer, except for Israel and Hamas as well. You know, they don't agree there's a two-state solution. And so that is, in a sense, the right-wing Israeli government and Hamas endorse each other by adopting that position, whereas a two-state solution would allow you to unlock it and get partners on the Palestinian side who aren't absolutists like Hamas, that then enables you to, you know, this is a much longer discussion, but you're absolutely right. It's geopolitically stalemated, and Israel can't achieve its goals in Gaza, you know, which are, his two goals are to wipe out Hamas. Well, good luck doing that to an irregular force in an urban area that's dug in deep into the ground in a tunnel network. Just not going to happen. And we can see that, right? You know, 3 months in, 25,000 civilians killed in the pursuit of that goal, including some of the hostages, which is another goal. And Hamas is still able to fire rockets at Israel. So they haven't even been able to degrade that capability, which is firing, you know, bombardment, which is one of the easier capabilities to knock out, right? Because it requires quite a big logistical footprint. So I think that's very, very telling. And of course, the other Israeli goal is to get the hostages. But there's a tension there between going after Hamas in a kind of very destructive way, which the Israelis are doing, and getting the hostages out. And there have been a number of hostages killed due to IDF action, which I think speaks to that tension at the heart of what Israel's trying to do. And notwithstanding the sort of geopolitical impasse that we've just described.
Absolutely. I totally agree with your analysis there. I want to ask you about the notion of assumptions as the basis of strategy, because if you're working with this ends, ways, and means equation, you are by implication, have to make assumptions about what you want to achieve. You have to make assumptions about what you have at your disposal. And I think, you know, looking at the war in Ukraine, if you consider that first month, 2 months of the war for Russia and the assumptions they have based their strategy on, it just went horribly wrong. Strategy, in a way, is dependent on the correctness, the thoroughness, the soundness of the assumptions that you are making and that you're basing your strategy on.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's what Clausewitz said, right? The supreme judgment of the commander is to determine what type of war it is that they're fighting and not to turn it into another type of war. And I think the most important thing you can do, because we're all humans, right? And the most common bias for leaders is overconfidence and hubris. And that's what we're talking about, right? Assumptions is if you're overconfident, then you go, ah, it's fine. Their logistics system will collapse. But actually, it turns out that their logistics system is much better than you thought it was. And that's as a result of your overconfidence. Yeah. And so to come to you know, what you're saying is to become to the correct assumptions, to rigorously test them, you've got to develop a structure and a process for coming to your judgments. It's not just sort of sitting there with a blank piece of paper and going, what are we going to do? You need a structure and a process. And what that means is a diverse team. You've got to have and I don't mean diversity in the sense of, you know, black, white, gay, straight. Obviously, that's very important dimensions of diversity. But what I really mean when I come to diversity is different ways of thinking. So you want a team that's got pessimists in it, optimists. You want a team that's got risk takers and conservatives and young and old and poor and rich. Because what that does is all of those characteristics I've just described, and there are many more, change your ways of thinking. And what you really want when you're testing a plan or assumptions, it's great if you've got an optimist and a pessimist and a risk taker and a risk averse person looking at a thing, because they'll all look at it from a different perspective. Yep. And through that discussion in that diverse team, they'll test and they'll go, actually, do you know what? That assumption is wrong. We need to change that. We need to downgrade that. We need to upgrade that. And that really is the absolutely critical thing. And it's really interesting. This has been known for a long time amongst humans. There's a really, really great book called Team of Rivals, which is about Abraham Lincoln's cabinet and during the Civil War. And basically, this cabinet was full of people who hated each other. But they were big beasts. They were really big men who'd done big things in their lives. And they hated each other. And they all thought completely differently. And Abraham Lincoln, through just very gentle, subtle chairing of the discussions and guiding that, and you know, it would constantly be on the verge of falling apart, but he managed to orchestrate the conversation and keep it going. And then eventually you started the plan that came out through steering this middle path between all these views was the plan that led to, the emancipation of slaves, for one, and of course, the winning of the Civil War, which are two, resounding feats at that time, really exemplary leadership and a great example of how you can take a group of people who think incredibly differently and actually are at loggerheads most of the time, but get the best solution out of it. And that's what I think leaders need to think most carefully about when they're trying to think about these assumptions that they base their plan on.
Yeah, I think this is where democracies has a huge advantage over an autocratic, a closed system, decision-making system, where you have diversity of opinion and thought. But I want to move on, perhaps just the last question on the fundamentals, bringing intelligence and logistics together, because what we are witnessing at the moment in war, of course, is perhaps two processes. The one is the dronification part of war. The other is the more precision part of war, that we're going more and more the precision way. And intelligence, both intelligence and logistics, will have to adjust, because precision warfare, the dronification of warfare, requires precision logistics and precision intelligence, is it not?
It does, and on the flip side as well. The dronification, it's a great word, by the way, I've never heard that before, and precision strike totally degrades your logistics as well if they're being used against you. So it's it's, you've got to do both. It's you've got to do both. It's, you can almost describe war these days as, or one way of looking at war these days is of hiders and seekers. Yeah. Because we have ubiquitous sensors on the battlefield and we've got really good data links, so everything's networked. And to get, from it's called from shooter to sensor, right? So, or sensor to shooter. Yeah. So you get your picture, you get your coordinates, and you get that straight away to something that's able to action it, be it an artillery piece, a drone, or whatever. That's very quick. And it's very cheap. And the costs are, dropping rapidly. So your tank that costs 500 million quid or 50 million quid or whatever is suddenly very, very vulnerable. And so there's a premium on being able to hide and mask your signatures, so particularly for logistics elements, but also there's a premium to be able to seek. And the battle, one way of describing modern warfare is this battle between hiders and seekers. And ultimately the army that is able to do that process quicker than their enemy is going to win, because they'll be able to, it's called the kill chain. Their kill chain will be operating quicker than the enemy's kill chain. And then of course, we've spoken about targeting logistics, but actually what you're really trying to do is target their kill chain. So you'll get two kill chains trying to target each other, where, they're just striking the sensors, or they're striking the strike assets, and they're just doing that, because once you've taken out your opponent's kill chain, then you can then look at, other things that they want to, that you want to take on. So it's a real evolution of war. And war, like everything else in modern life, war's speeding up.
It is speeding up, but in the process, it has become a very dangerous place for the infantryman, eh?
Yeah, certainly. Back to hiding. And I think, progressively we're going to see replacements of, in one regard, humans, the infantryman is utterly essential to warfare. Because everything really is arranged around supporting that infantryman, because at the end of the day, you need people in your opponent's village, as I said. But you're right, it's an incredibly lethal place for an infantryman. So the question is there protective mobility we can give them? Or ultimately, in 10 years' time, do we start to see the beginnings of the replacement of human infantiers with robots? Or is there an intermediary phase where you augment humans? Because actually the things that robots, the reason infantiers are great is because they can deal with rough terrain, able to make decisions on the spot, all the rest of it. There's lots of things that humans are just much, much, much better at than robots. And, is there an intermediary stage where we augment humans, be that with drugs, to enhance their perception ability to stay awake, all the rest of it, or with exoskeletons that enable them to have greater protection or to carry heavier loads. And I'm not talking about a kind of suit of armor type thing, but it can just be something quite simple that on their back and on their legs, it just gives them extra strength and ability to carry a much heavier load that enables them to keep going. I think there's a number of things in the pipeline in different militaries around the world that are looking at that problem and how to solve that problem.
Yeah, it's interesting what you are saying, because there's a lot of questions about whether, and I like the word kill chain. It's making so much sense to me, whether we are in a process of dehumanizing the kill chain, but at the same time, you know, war is such a deeply human reality. You cannot ignore the fact that war is a deeply human phenomenon. It is, you will never be able to dehumanize the phenomenon. You can try and dehumanize the kill chain, but not the reality of war. I want you to talk a little bit, because I really like that last part of where you're actually bringing the integration and explaining the integration of the infantryman, the tank, and the artillery. And what people often don't understand about the different weapon systems is that success on the battlefield is about the successful integration of the strengths and the weaknesses of the different weapon systems, that only if you are successful in creating a network type of integration of the infantry, the armor, the artillery, the air weapon, and you bring it together, only then will you be able to successfully apply and be successful in operationalizing the kill chain in many ways. And I think, you know, looking at the first part of the war and in Ukraine, how Russia got that wrong, and because of that, the artillery were taken out, the tanks were taken out in a piecemeal way.
Yeah, I think one of the things that Russia learned to its cost was that, you know, and this speaks to a very, very common mistake in war, but what they learned to their cost was that you can buy all of this great technology, which basically after Georgia in 2008, Russia realized that its ground forces were in a really terrible state. And they went through this big program of modernization where they bought lots of new kits. As you know, there's this May Day parade celebrating the end of the Second World War in Moscow. And it's amazing, you know, amazing rows of tanks and all the rest of it. It looks fantastic. But what they discovered was actually it's training, integration, doctrine, understanding the strengths and weaknesses of different weapon systems, as you put it so well. And then drilling those people. And of course, actually going to war. There's nothing like going to war to learn. One of the reasons the Brits and the Americans historically have been good at war is because they fight lots of wars. But this thing that it speaks to, this wider thing that it speaks to, is we see in war technology as a savior, right? But it's not. War is a deeply human phenomenon, and technology is useful. It's great, right? But ultimately, someone else will, it's an arms race. So you come up with drones, then your opponent comes up with a laser that can shoot the drones down, right? So, you know, someone will come up with another technology to kind of defeat your technology. And you're still left with this human phenomenon, which at its heart has psychology. And that's not going to change, potentially until we get artificial intelligence. And then, you know, that's a whole nother discussion. But the deeply human essence of warfare, which is based on psychology, so, you know, wars always have the same dynamics. They're about bluff, deceit, retreat, attack, all that kind of stuff. That's not going to change no matter which technologies you add in until we get to AI, which is probably another discussion. And armies and leaders consistently make the mistake that this new technology, and we see this all the time in history, they get excited about a new technology that's going to solve war for them. Oh, we've got the tech, we can win with this technology. But actually, it's all about, comes down to humans always.
Yeah, it's interesting. Professor Colin Gray describes this very interestingly, where he talks about the technophiles and the technophobes, you know, and the tension you're sitting there between those two ideas, the one side thinking that all the solutions to the problem in the world is to be found in technology, the other side of the coin, the thinking that every solution in the world is to be found in the human spirit. And we know that truth is somewhere between these two extremes. Right. That's the reality. Yeah, that But I want to ask you one last question. It's a really interesting discussion. Because based on the book, we have to reflect on what is at present going on in Ukraine and Israel, and perhaps look into the glass bowl and make a prediction as to how this will play out. I like the ideas that you offer in your book about the mutually hurting stalemate on the one hand and the total destruction defeat as the two sort of traditional outcomes in war. You want to offer us some sort of views on how you think this is going to unfold?
Just a couple of easy questions to finish off on. I think, look, I mean, the Ukraine war is not the Ukraine war. The Ukraine war is deciding where the eastern border of Europe is. And this is a question that we've, you know, debated before. And sometimes it gets settled in one place and sometimes it gets settled in another. And we're currently just readjusting, or Russia is trying to readjust where that border is. I think the outcome very much depends on whether the US and Europe decides to lean in, because the problem is that if the conflict freezes as it does now, or Russia is able to, you know, there's some sort of peace deal and Russia is able to annex that territory, you know, I'd be very concerned if I lived in Lithuania or Latvia or Estonia. The country that's done the greatest military expansion in the last 5 years is Poland. Poland's army, they bought something like 600 MLRSs, hundreds of main battle tanks. You know, they know what's coming. Finland as well, now in NATO, very, very capable. But there's a huge question mark over, of course, if Donald Trump gets elected, what that means for the Article 5 security guarantee in NATO. So really, at the moment, we're in a stalemate, and I think the ball is in the court of the Western nations to decide what they want to do about that. But there's very, very grave consequences if they don't get their acts together. On Israel, Gaza, I think the reason that Israel is adopting the position it's adopting now is because Netanyahu knows that basically October the 7th happened partly because of his approach as leader, as prime minister, and he's very, very unpopular in Israel as a result. There's a lot of blame laid at his door. He knows that as soon as the war ends, you know, countries don't tend to change leaders when they're at war. He knows that as soon as the war ends, he's out on his ear. And so he's adopting this maximalist position in order to keep the war, keep prosecuting the war. Everybody's utterly exasperated with him. You know, Israel squandered all the goodwill and sympathy that it had after the appalling attacks of October the 7th. And you can see a number of European countries particularly, but also the Americans, who are starting to lean in much more to the two-state solution, starting to, you know, the UK a couple of days ago said that potentially they could recognize the Palestinian state as a way of making the two-state outcome irreversible. So giving a political horizon that the Palestinians can look at and see. It's going to be hard to do that with Netanyahu in charge. How long is Netanyahu going to be in charge, I think, is the question. If they had fresh elections in Israel, what would the government look like? Would it have so many ultra right-wingers in, which, of course, are the parties that Netanyahu's relying on for staying in power? I think these are all very interesting questions. So there I see that as an impasse around Netanyahu, but once Netanyahu goes, that does unlock it. I think the one thing that the October the 7th attacks have done is they've thrown everything up in the air and made everybody realize actually that we need to double down and get back to the two-state solution, because that's the only game in town. For a long time, I think that everyone's just switched off from it. And that's, you know, whilst they've switched off from it, it's kind of bubbled along. Hamas has still been rotting Israel. Israeli settlers have still been moving into the West Bank. You know, it's just sort of crept along below the radar, but it's got back on the table in a big way because of October the 7th and because of the response to it. And I think that it poisons the rest of the Middle East, the conflict, as we can see now with, you know, the Red Sea attacks and the Houthis and, you know, Hezbollah and so on and so forth. And I think whereas the Americans previously wanted to ignore what was going on there and just let it bubble along, please don't let the Middle East get in the news. Biden, you know, famously said when he became president, I just don't want to see the Middle East. Your job is to manage it. Now I think it's back on the agenda. And countries are starting to lean in. But, you know, to unlock that, to move it forward, there are a number of things on the table: recognition of Palestinian statehood, Saudi Arabia recognizing Israel. But it all has to be locked into a longer term two-state solution, the starting point of which, of course, is a ceasefire and the return of the hostages. And frankly, the sidelining of Hamas, right? And finding other political actors on the Palestinian side who are able to take that forward for the Palestinians. So yeah, again, a bit of a geopolitical stalemate, but potential for it to be unlocked, providing that there is a change in Israeli leadership.
Well, a better way of operationalizing your discussion on strategy we've just sort of witnessed. So thank you so much for that. This is precisely what strategy is about, and your chapter on strategy is about. I think I'm going to draw the line here. Very interesting book. I'm definitely going to recommend it to my students to read, and I'm looking forward to see it in South Africa in the bookshops. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Abel.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.